To Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 16th episode. Wild Trekker is a series of podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. This week I'm offering another archival interview I've done, a conversation with the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, who's been a professor at McGill University here in Montreal. That's where I first got to know him. Also, Chicheley Professor of Social and Political Theory at Oxford University, and a visiting scholar at various other institutions around the world. He's won major awards for his contributions to modern thought, like the $1.5 million Templeton Award for progress towards research or discoveries about spiritual realities, and the $1 million Berggruen Prize as a thinker whose ideas are of broad significance for shaping human self-understanding and the advancement of humanity. Charles Taylor is actually a very approachable person, and his view of the world is grounded in Catholic spirituality. I've read quite a few of his books, but the one that made the deepest impact on me has been Sources of the Self, which aims to lay out the history of modern identity. As he explains, the book is an attempt to articulate and write a history of the modern identity, what it is to be a human agent, the senses of inwardness, freedom, individuality, and being embedded in nature, which are at home in the modern West. The book explores identity and the good, inwardness, the affirmation of ordinary life, the voice of nature, and the conflicts of modernity. Since I'm concerned about the encroachments of artificial intelligence and computers on human lives, I've studied this area as well, tracing through history the idea of the instrumental control of the material world, and therefore of people, which in my view risks reducing people to the level of mere machines. All this at a time when technological developments are making machines increasingly powerful. I meet Charles Taylor here in Montreal.
So in reading Sources of the Self, I was struck by the way you present naturalist instrumentalism as a kind of force for the production of new knowledge, but at the same time as something which, in a way, weakens our sense of identity.
Yeah, I mean, it weakens our sense of identity. It doesn't allow us to get at our sense of identity. The thing is that our sense of our identity as human beings turns around the things that are really most important to us. Somebody's identity is closely linked with what really is important to them, right? You say, my identity is as a Canadian or as a Catholic or as this or that. I mean that these things are so important to me that without them as kind of orienting landmarks, I wouldn't really know where I stand. So I'm talking about things that are important to us. But the problem with the language of naturalist instrumentalism, a language which tries to explain human beings in the language of natural science, it doesn't have the language to talk about what's important. Identity and identity definition go together. I mean, we only have identities because we have ways of defining them, or we're offered ways of defining them, or we rebel against these ways of defining them, or we try to redefine them, or whatever, right? Or we struggle with other people, our parents, about how to define them. So identity definitions and, I mean, identity landmarks and ways of defining them go together. And that means that we are into languages which just are totally different from the languages of natural science. Highly contextualized languages, languages which make sense in the context of a certain experience or a certain relationship or a certain way we stand to historical tradition and so on and so on and so on. And it's only by cultivating these languages that we can have a human identity. So this whole attempt to explain human beings in ways continuous with natural science just passes beside, fails to touch, leaves entirely out of account what is really important to them as human beings, which we can grasp at with a word like identity.
Do you think that the world of virtuality, the world of computer reproduced reality, or a way of representing things mathematically and then using graphics in a way that convinces us somehow it resembles the real, could this virtuality ever replace our human experience?
Well, no. I mean, you just have to look at, when we're talking now about what's really important again, you just have to look at how important it is for human beings to be in touch with the real. And a good example for this, which is very much available to us, is the whole of modern tourism. I mean, a lot of modern tourism consists of what? People want to go to places where, I mean, there are other kinds of things. They want to go to see Niagara Falls. But I mean, when people travel to Europe and Asia, they want to go to places where really important historical events happened, marking events in our culture. And they want to be there, really be there. They will, you know, they go and visit Mozart's house in Vienna, and they want to be in the room where he composed, or Freud's, his even bigger house in Vienna. Yeah, we want to be in the room where he wrote, you know, The Future of an Illusion and so on. And the guy tells you this, and you get a kind of thrill, right? It depends on this idea of we're really touching the real. There's no way you could substitute for that on the level of meaning. People, and if you did manage to kid people into thinking that they were in touch with the real through some makeup, as soon as you reveal this, it'd be a terrible disappointment, not to say lawsuits, right? Because what matters to us is this contact with the real. That can never be substituted for.
You've traced the path of this very powerful idea, very compelling idea, that everything can be represented in terms of mathematics or the methods of natural science. Where actually does the idea come from? Can it be stated in a reasonably straightforward way?
Well, I think, I have several answers to this. You can very easily see where the ambition comes from, because with a decontextualized language like mathematics, you can really get an intellectual grasp of something, right? You can get a real hold on it. It's not something that is going to slide away from you when you look at it from another angle, as you do with any deeply contextualized language, right? You step outside the bounds of Christianity, and these words don't mean anything to you. Or you step into Buddhism, something else means to you. But with this highly decontextualized language of mathematics, you can get a real grip on something. So there's a certain side of the human mind that says, wouldn't it be fantastic? The degree of intellectual control. And then following that, of course, it's in some cases manipulative control, because once you get intellectual control, granted certain other things, you can have a certain manipulative control, right? So you have, I mean, the guy you can see really having a high on this in the history of philosophy is Descartes. And you have his wonderful passage in the discourse on method, where he talks about this new science that he sees developing and how this can, we can get a real certain grasp on this, so we have certainty. And then he says, this can make us maîtres et possesseurs de la nature. We'll be masters and possessors of nature, right? So one source is that you've got a fantastic high thinking what you can, the kind of control, intellectual control, and then real control, and the kind of certainty, unchallengeability. But what makes this plausible is that in certain departments of human life, using the means of natural science, we have got that kind of control on the kind of things we explain in the language of physics or chemistry. We have got that kind of intellectual control, and it's paid off in the following kinds of technological control. So now you have this, what originally is kind of dream, wow, wouldn't it be great if, suddenly becomes a partial reality, and then you just have to make one more little step and say all the things that seem to be refractory to that, well, we'll find a way of putting them into the box and grasping them in those terms. And that's been the drama, if you like, intellectual drama of the West for the last three centuries. The temptation to think you can grasp the human in terms of the dead stuff around us, the world around us, and the myriad attempts to do that falling on their face in this way, that way, and that other way. But the temptation is so strong that the hope never dies. And if you look at the history of the sciences of human life, you can see a human existence, you can see attempt after attempt after attempt turning into nonsense and getting nowhere and so on. But instead of being replaced by a sense that this is not going to work, it's replaced by another different kind of attempt. I mean, it'd just be autobiographical for a minute. When I was first studying things like the philosophy of psychology, the great form then was behaviorism. You could understand everything in terms of simple behavioral movements of stimulus and response. And this ran into the ground. It became clear that it was ridiculous. It couldn't ever work. But as soon as that fell, what immediately succeeded it was another attempt, the attempt now through computers to understand human thinking, where behaviorists said, no such thing as thinking. We'll explain it all by the movement of stimulus response. These other guys said, sure, there's something is thinking, but we can give a completely materialist explanation of thinking. What thinking is, the brain is like a digital computer, right? So we'll find a way of understanding the brain. And now we've been through four decades of that, and it's beginning to show that it's not going to work. And so, but, you know, they'll come up with something else, I guarantee you.
Now, you were saying like a machine just now, and when I think of the evolution of technology since the Renaissance, and which has coincided with this tremendous activity, I don't know if I should say progress, but activity in the natural sciences, the metaphor has changed a lot because the technology has changed. Leonardo compared human functions to cables and pulleys, and Harvey compared the heart to a pump, and Descartes compared the human body to a series of trick fountains. And the metaphor has developed a lot. But where I find things changing now is that these new technologies to which human beings are being compared are much more sophisticated than before. And in some ways, they are able to mimic certain human functions, and they are able to improve on them. I couldn't possibly make billions of mathematical calculations per second. I actually wouldn't want to, but that's another issue. But don't you feel that the metaphor has become weighted in favor of technology when people say, yes, 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 human beings are like machines?
Well, yes, in some ways, but also no, in some way. I mean, this becomes, even the more sophisticated they are in some ways, the more evidently inhuman they are. You know, if you know what I mean? I mean non-human or different from human. I mean, the fact that you can have these machines that beat chess masters because they can do calculations so much more quickly. As a matter of fact, they do it ways chess masters don't. They do it by this counting out method, right? Which would take us a century to do. You know, if I do this, he does that, and so on. And so you can see the non-human side of that. And this becomes evident with computers when you see that, as people have shown, the higher the function, as we think of it in our civilization, is the more it's something to do with sophisticated mathematical thinking, the more a computer can match and sometimes surpass us in a certain time period, the lower the function, like being able to walk around the room, maneuver, pick up things, put them down, and so on, is devilishly hard, close to impossible, to imitate on a computer because it involves the skills we have as bodily beings, right? So you can see the gap between the non-human and the human breaking apart here just as clearly. However, you're right that it becomes invisible under the following conditions. If people are so deeply into the ideology of modernity, as it were, that they have this certain hierarchy of the higher and lower functions, where doing mathematics is a higher function and being able to walk around the room is a lower function, right? Because it's what we have with the animals. If that's your idea of high and low, then it's kind of obvious thought, gee, if this thing can do the highest, you know, then, I mean, obviously it's got the essence of the human, because the essence of the human is what distinguishes us from the animals, right? And so we've got something that's really human. If you have another view of what the really important about human beings, for instance, is their capacity to love, not their capacity to do higher mathematics, which is what makes them extraordinary, then this will seem totally implausible to you that computers can match us, right? Just change the gestalt, change the context in which you're thinking about this, and what looks fantastically plausible suddenly appears absurdly implausible.
A few weeks ago, I went to Boston, where I met Raymond Kurzweil, who's a great inventor and a visionary of artificial intelligence and a best-selling author, etc. And he says that within 20 years, computers will be so powerful that they will significantly surpass human intelligence, and they will themselves convince us that they are spiritual beings, and we will not be able to tell the difference.
Well, not being able to tell the difference is absolutely crazy when you think of it for a minute. I mean, what is it that tells you that you're a human being? Certainly another human being. Certainly not that they can do Euclid's geometry quickly in their heads. Most of the people I know have never been like that. I mean, you can shake their hand. You have a sense of warmth. You can sit down and have a beer and talk to them and have a real sense of the meeting of minds or meeting of hearts, or a sense of not, because they're really holding things back. And so it's all those things. We haven't got a millimeter closer to being able to match that with a computer than we were in the Stone Age. Huh? All the things that they have matched are these extremely abstract forms, right? So the idea of extrapolating from being able to get a chess machine, Deep Blue or something, that can beat, or on an off day can beat the chess master, extrapolating from that to being able to sit down and have a beer with something which is not really a human being with transistors inside. It's just wild. This is fairy tale stuff. I mean, this has as much plausibility as the Grimm's fairy tales about the pot talking to the kettle and so on. Or the, you know.
But if I look at the way this is developed, and reading your book, The Sources of the Self, I was very struck by how you showed the historical development of it, something which you're very interested in. There are different types of people on the natural instrumentalist side. And some are the discoverers, like Galileo, whose claims are not really that sweeping. Others are philosophizers, like Descartes or like Hobbes, who actually in the details misunderstood a lot of things, extrapolated very extravagantly from what little they understood in Galileo. And then they went on from there to create a whole new paradigm, which actually doesn't hold together.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what's always happening. So you wonder why this doesn't run out after a while. The sense that maybe we're doing something wrong in this whole extrapolation. of course, that catches on. It catches on with lots of people. That's what I've been saying for years, and I'm lots of other people saying it too. Why does that never become the dominant stance in our intellectual culture? Well, there again, we have to go back to the deeper sources of this. Why it is something that's seen as so tremendously, seductively interesting and exciting, and people want to believe in this frontier, want to believe in one of these analogies working, even though they have constantly to scrap the previous one and start with a new one in order to get. And even though everybody who's in the present one will agree with you about the total implausibility of the one before that was being operative.
Because actually, natural science is a self-correcting enterprise, and it's the knowledge itself, the knowledge base, is rather unstable.
That's right. That's right. But these great models, they're not. I mean, the thing is, you have to go to Thomas Kuhn's famous analysis of this. Everyone works within a framework, which he calls paradigm, and the big scientific leaps are when you break an earlier paradigm and build a new paradigm, right? And what we have here is constantly these paradigms for explaining human life in some mechanistic analogy, like the computer one, breaking down. But there is no real progress here because the breakdown never produces a new paradigm of that sort, which is any more successful than the earlier ones. I mean, what Kuhn shows is that in real science, new paradigms, I mean, you move from Aristotelian idea that all bodies, in order to be moving, have to be pushed at the same time by some force, right? To the inertial idea of Galileo, that bodies proceed linear motion unless interfered with. And that shift allows you to understand a whole lot of anomalies that were plaguing the earlier mechanics, and you can see why they were anomalies and why they aren't anomalies today and so on. You have this great leap forward where you can explain a lot of stuff that was going wrong before. And that doesn't happen with these paradigm shifts in mechanistic reductive science, right? Well, I mean, they get rid of the earlier anomalies because they aren't trying the same way, but they don't. There's no great breakthrough where they get farther and make things about human life more limpid and understandable. Never.
What would you say are the main differences between a computer and a person, and don't say everything?
Well, the essential thing is that what we think of as a human being, as a person, and here we're getting something so basic, let's not even say just persons, let's say animals, is that things matter to them in a certain way. I mean, for instance, they can be in pain. Right? Descartes had this big problem, right, that he thought that because the non-spiritual side of us was simply a machine, and because animals didn't have souls, animals were just machines, and you shouldn't be worried when you kick your dog and it yelps because it's just, you know, a machine set up to make this noise. Doesn't we all know that's absurd, right? We all know that's monstrously absurd, right? That these beings can suffer. When can a computer suffer? We don't even, and there's no way this language can even get a hold on it, right? So we're talking about them in the most basic way. Things matter to living beings. And then human beings, of course, have all sorts of ways in which things matter, which animals don't. I mean, like being in anguish about whether my life has meaning and so on, right? That's the difference. I mean, it's almost like answering everything. It's the essential point. The fact that there is a point to our lives, right? This is what differentiates us.
Do you think that there could be a way of striking a balance with our spiritual nature on the one side and as much of the benefits of natural science as we have time for on the other side, which would make the spiritual outlook not seem to be on the defensive, which would give spiritual people a chance to be really enriched by many discoveries, for example, in genomics, in astrophysics, in artificial intelligence, in computer science, in medical science, because there's so many things coming out that really could shift the perspective in a way, but may not alter fundamentally the spiritual nature of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that we have a different sense of who we are when we see just how that there is a meaning to life and so on emerges out of this, well, first of all, living stuff that we are, which we see happening in every individual human life. And of course, we see happening over evolution too, right? So we see in these two, we weren't there for almost evolution, but we get some idea of what went on there, and then we are there for the development of ourselves and our children and so on. And understanding just in what way, how these things hang together, is something we get immense new insights into as a result of the advancing of life sciences.
Do you think that our understanding of evolution, which is being reinforced by the discoveries of genomics, the human genome, and the similarity between our own genome and that of the lowly mouse or the worm, is this going to teach us more about how bonded we are to nature?
Yeah, I think that, I don't think it's going to teach us more, because I think that in the last, let's say, 200 years, is it 200, something like that, in Western culture, there has been immense growth in the sense of our being bonded to the rest of nature. I mean, I think this is one of the things that evolution, Darwin, not only Darwin, because it started before, actually, strangely enough, it started before there were really good theories of this. In a sense, the sense of being part of it all predates, that's what's interesting, predates almost as a condition for the development of evolutionary thought rather than the other way around. But it's certainly become entrenched by that. I think that is a really important part of contemporary Western self-understanding, which was different from other ages.
If we look at the machine as a metaphor, it's a metaphor that can create a kind of an intellectual context for people to analyze certain functions. And this is something that Hobbes mentioned in The Citizen. It was a way of breaking things apart and putting them back together again. But isn't the metaphor really of use to people as long as it doesn't become an equation?
Well, very, very carefully. I mean, take this very important piece of the or dimension of the metaphor, which is the famous Hobbes thing about taking it apart and putting it together again, right? And the resultative compositive method, right? Now, and take the whole business of the human genome. Plainly, it works sort of that way sometimes, but a lot of the time not. I mean, what I mean by it works, the whole business of the human genome is we want to be able to somehow relate different traits of human beings, properties and traits, with the genome, various bits of the genes, right? And one-on-one linkages sometimes work. I mean, it does appear that susceptibility to certain diseases can be traced to a very small bit of the whole DNA thing. So if you tweak that, for instance, you can get a situation where the person is no longer susceptible to that disease or no longer likely to have that disease, which is really great. The idea that you could repeat this right the way through. So let's say you have a trait like being good at mathematics or, you know, being a nice guy or being very fast on your feet or making speeches like Churchill and so on. It's crazy. It could never be like that. And we don't have the foggiest idea how all the different things in that genome somehow come together with the way the cape was brought up and so on to make a Winston Churchill in 1940. We haven't the foggiest idea. But the ideology here rolls on as though the full Hobbesian atomistic program were possible. In other words, as though you could find the thing to tweak to make your kid Einstein and another thing to tweak to make him Churchill. And then you get these really surreal discussions going on in the press. Like, I mean, should we do this? I mean, isn't this going to give an advantage to people who can pay for the gene tweaker to make their kid a medical genius or other people and so on? You have these discussions racing on in the press, which are, to my horror, I've had discussions with people in biotech industry where they talk in the same terms, but they must know better. That's, you know, so why are they doing this? Well, we come back to this thing, we keep returning to it, the immense, seductive, exciting idea that we could have this degree of control intellectually and then de facto is just so powerful that you forget the limits of the metaphor, right? So the metaphor is helpful. when you're trying to make a little tweak to make sure that people aren't susceptible to such and such a disease, but the metaphor becomes immediately blinding.
But if we look at where the idea came from, Hobbes had fantasies of control. He also had the type of personality to go through a conversion experience when he opened Euclid's Geometry. He also misunderstood Galileo in thinking that matter and motion could explain everything in the entire universe, including his own ideas. And then he was a person basically terrified of any kind of political or social change, and he wanted a kind of stagnant, rigidly regimented, ordered society, hierarchical, where basically there would be no liberty.
Well, it wasn't hierarchical, I mean, in an ordinary sense, but it did have absolute rule, right? I mean, so he was what people call a control freak. Now, you can see this very, very deeply done in all sorts of ways. For instance, his talking about power and his definition of power in the Leviathan is entirely about controlling, right? Power is controlling the future. And his obsession in the political realm came from very deep fear of the insecurity, which he did live through. Let's give it to him. I mean, he lived through very tough, insecure times, the English Civil War. I wouldn't like to have been alive at various moments in England at that time, so I'm not knocking him. But his reaction to that was to want a completely all-controlling authority on top of everybody, right? There, everyone's going to stay in place. Nobody move, right? And that's... that is part of the, you can see the personality of this man, his fears and seeping out of the text on every page.
Do you see the fantasy of technocratic control today as being in a way linked historically to Hobbes?
Yeah, it's the control freakery, if you like, is very much the same phenomenon. Now, in the case of Hobbes, it's actuated by a tremendous fear of what happens if you let go, right? Get this civil war with all these armies marching all over the country, and then nobody is stopping the brigands from coming in and smashing into your house. Okay? For a lot of people today, it's a much more serene, even utopian idea. Control is, we can make everybody happy, we can make everybody live in a wonderful world, we can float along and so on. So there are different, if you like, motivational tonalities to this desire for control. But control freakery is one of the big driving forces of our civilization.
I don't see this as an either-or proposition. Life has taught me to avoid either-or thinking. I believe a person can be both scientifically minded and spiritual. Science provides us with new knowledge. Our spiritual nature provides us with meaning. What I like about the exchange with Charles Taylor is its focus on identity and meaning, on the importance of lived human experience, which includes suffering, something computers could never experience, and his very funny characterization of the Hobbesian will to control everything as control freakry. I just love that expression. You may have listened to my archival interview with the late Sir John Sulston, former head of the British part of the Human Genome Project. This was a big science project at the beginning of the millennium, publicly funded, involving international collaboration, and it set a template for scientific research around the world. The purpose of this project was to sequence and map all 46,800 genes of our species, Homo sapiens, from a physical and functional standpoint, as well as the roundworm and the fruit fly, in order to identify the genetic causes of some diseases. This amounted to developing the complete genetic blueprint for humanity. I've interviewed many leading scientists who worked on the Human Genome Project, but I don't remember any of them suggesting this blueprint included discovering the genetic basis of psychological and intellectual traits, and the blueprint was not meant to help us build human beings from scratch. Of course, sequencing technologies have been used since then to map the genomes of many different species, fish to whales, reptiles to mice, mosquitoes to monkeys and birds, and a wide variety of plants, all of which demonstrates the unity of life. In other words, groundbreaking scientific knowledge doesn't just stretch the mind and offer up new vistas of understanding. It has huge implications for spirituality because, at a certain level, the unity of life is a spiritual value.
Thank you.
If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And evidencia is the Latin word for evidence. It's spelled E-V-I-D-E-N, as in normal, T-I-A, evidencia. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmeaux on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This podcast is copyright 2020, George Toombs, all rights reserved.